This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Our talk today is on a very, very contemporary, very, very pertinent topic in today's society, especially for Muslims. It's on Islamophobia and counterterrorism in the UK. And Brother Abdullah Andalusi is giving the talk. I'd like to give you a brief introduction as to who the brother is. He's an international speaker, thinker, intellectual activist for Islam. He has delivered international talks on the issues of the existence of God, the miracle of the Quran, Islamic finance, furthermore, topics like that, like secularism, liberalism, democracy. And he's talked on primetime television as well. Some of them include BBC ITV, BBC Arabic, BBC Radio, Al Jazeera, Press TV, Islam Channel, and Iqra TV. He's also engaged with atheists, secularists, agnostics, liberals, and Christians on a variety of different topics, from theology to political philosophy. I'd like to please ask you guys to put your hands together for Brother Abdullah Andalusi.
Rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, as-salatu wa-salamu nabi kareem Muhammad wa ala alihi tayyibin wa sahbihi salihin. I greet you all with the Islamic greetings of peace. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. First of all, I'd like to thank the University of Surrey Student Union and Islamic Society for inviting me again to speak to you today. I'd also like to thank the audience for your attendance. I think I came here a couple months ago to discuss, I think it was proof of God, I think it was, and it was a pleasure back then, and it's a pleasure now to speak to you and address you on another topic, which is obviously not of the same gravity in one way, theologically speaking, but is something that's quite pertinent to all of us today. And that is Islamophobia and counterterrorism, and the question of whether there's any connection between counterterror policies by certain Western governments and Islamophobia that we see pervading Western society. Now, the organizers describe this lecture as being one where Britain's counterterrorism policies, which have promoted the growth of Islamophobia and a sense of hostility felt by Muslims. And so the description of this event discussed how this would be demonstrated. However, I'm not going to be telling you that counterterrorism policies have promoted or led to a growth of in Islamophobia. I will merely give you the evidences and allow you to decide that for yourself. So you make the judgments based on the evidences that you hear, and in the Q&A, if you believe that I have failed to mention any evidences or there are other counter-narratives that I have missed out, then I'll give the opportunity to raise them as a question or comment or a criticism, and I wholeheartedly welcome that. Now, as is common in all university arenas, the first thing that's always discussed is, what is the definition of the words used? Because we always hear words used, radicalization, terrorism, Islamophobia, extremist, Islamist. But what do, or moderate even, but what do any of these words actually even mean? And there you'll find the problems and confusions, as in Western history is a famous saying, the devil's in the detail. So let's have a look at this. Now, Islamophobia is a key term, and so we need to define it in order to categorize or be able to have a criteria to know what sentiments or expressions or activities are actually Islamophobic. So I'll give it from a non-controversial source, the Oxford English Dictionary. And the Oxford English Dictionary defines Islamophobia quite interestingly. It says, It is a dislike or prejudice against Islam or Muslims, especially as a political force. The same dictionary explains that prejudice refers to hostility and dislike based on preconceived or unfounded opinions. And it's quite fascinating that the Oxford English Dictionary includes the dislike or hostility to Islam, especially if considering or in situations where it being a political force is being discussed. It also should be noted that the Oxford English Dictionary definition of terrorism is also something we have to understand before we can look at if there's any connections or links between counterterrorism policy and Islamophobia, and whether counterterrorism policy is dealing with terrorism, or is it, or some of these policies dealing with more than just terrorism. So terrorism is defined in the OED, I'll put it for short, as the unlawful use of violence and intimidation, especially against civilians in the pursuit of political aims. Now, it's interesting because the OED defines terrorism by reference only to the methodology that's used and not any ideology that it is being done for. So someone becomes a terrorist attack or a terror action, an action of attacking or using terrorism or employing terrorism, based upon the description of the action and not on the cause or the reason that it is done, other than it merely being a political goal of some kind. So it says in pursuit of political aims. Now, it might sound obvious thing to mention that, okay, yeah, well, terrorism is violence done in pursuit of political aims. But if you think about it, it's very important and it's mostly missed out by the discourse we find in politics and by these pundits. Because, see, terrorism is a mercenary methodology. It cares not for whom it serves. It can be employed by any group or people under any flag, any cause, any nationalism, any ideology, any religion, any reason whatsoever, under any grievance. So it's not, by its definition, it's not limited to any one particular ideology or one particular religion. But then this brings a more interesting question. Is there a connection between someone's ideas and terrorism? So if someone believes in, let's say, women deserve to vote, does that lead to terrorism? Does any of you think that the idea of women deserve to vote wouldn't lead to violence? Anyone of you think that? Do you think it's a violence-inducing idea? No, you sure? Are you sure no one has committed violence in the name of that idea? Anyone study history here? Any history students? Okay. what was it? Is it mostly, what this university is famous for, was it computing, engineering, and all those types of things, yeah? Ah, suffragettes. One brother switched on. Yes, indeed, the suffragettes used actions which were the dictionary definition of terrorism. They set fire to post offices or post boxes. They attacked politicians. Didn't kill them, but apparently it was leading up to that. But they attacked people brutally, and they set off firebombs and things in London in order to secure women the vote. Now, obviously, side point is, they weren't responsible for women having the vote. They weren't I know it's portrayed in popular media that the suffragettes enabled women to get the vote in the UK. No, it wasn't them. It was the suffragists. The suffragists were the mainstream women's movement, which didn't use violent means, but their idea, their ideology was exactly the same, which was women deserve to vote, but they took a different method, a different methodology. Yeah, peaceful political lobbying and campaigning. The suffragists were the ones who managed to convince enough of the MPs on all parties such that all the parties voted in majority for women to have universal suffrage. It wasn't the suffragettes. They were the violent movement. You always hear about the violent movement, but it was the mainstream movement that won, much like you have the Black Panthers during the Black Civil Rights Movement in the United States. Right? Black Panthers were a militant group. What was their ideology? Was it black supremacism? No. Was it some kind of black nationalism, or was it just an ideology that says you must kill people who are white? No. The ideology was pretty simple, which was that people who are African Americans deserve the same treatment as people who are European Americans. I like calling them whites. European Americans. Let's remind everyone of their immigrant status. Yeah. So, and we should call maybe Native Americans just Americans. So the European Americans and the African Americans should have equal ability to vote. That was the ideology of the Black Panthers. But, okay, there was a few other socialists and other kind of Marxist overtones here and there, but that was one of their ideas. sharing that same idea was the movement led by very famous peaceful activists who, anyone know who was one of the main leaders of the black movement for suffrage of African Americans? Martin Luther King, yeah, that's an easy one. All right, so Martin Luther King and through him and his movement, through political lobbying, campaigning, demonstrating, protesting, they're the ones who managed to secure the objective. But their idea was shared by a militant group who enacted, in certain cases, militant activities or violence to seek that political objective. In South Africa, you have the anti-apartheid movements, the ANC, and they were against apartheid of the Dutch-originated Boers and the rest of the population of South Africa. And ANC was meant to be the peaceful and political wing. There was a militant wing called Umkhonto Mseezwe, which means Spirit of the Nation, and they used terror attacks, bombings, shopping malls, restaurants, and other public places, killing men, women, and children, to seek the same goal. Now, what people don't seem to remember is that Nelson Mandela was also the head of Umkhonto Sizwe. He was imprisoned, and he was asked by the government to tell his group, this militant group, to stop their militant activities. And his response was, well, you stop apartheid and oppressing my people, and then I'll tell this group to stop. And so people don't realize that aspect. But what was the ideology of Nelson Mandela? Some people say initially it was communism, but it became what you might call liberal democracy or secular liberal democracy. And he did it under the name secular liberal democracy. So there was a militant wing, and there was a mainstream peaceful political wing. They happened to share the same ideology, but not the same methodology. So then, is ideology connected to terrorism? No. People can be connected to terrorism, but ideology does not necessitate one method or another method. And this is the problem here when, if you imagine, or the discourse is that the problem with terrorism is due to some aspect of the people's beliefs. Their beliefs, which might be non-violent in nature, but these non-violent beliefs lead to violence. When you hear this particular rhetoric, know that there's something very wrong happening here, and there is a nefarious purpose intended by that rhetoric, because simple analysis of human history, sociology, and all these cases show that an ideology can be responsible for peaceful movements as it can be responsible for militant movements. So let's ask the burning question: is any interpretation or substrand or even distortion of Islam responsible for terrorist violence? Well, let's start by asking the terrorists themselves, so to speak. Al Jazeera, I believe in 2003, had an interview with Osama bin Laden. And they asked him, how can he enact terror violence, attacking America, American interests, attacking American civilians? So he said that there was a religious and logical argument to it. And people said, okay, well, explain the religious argument. Well, he said, well, the religious argument is one where people generally cite the hadith of the Prophet Muhammad, which said that it is prohibited to kill women and children in war, you know, basically non-combatants. So Algeria interview was like, oh, well, exactly. So then why do you justify it then if you've admitted that basically it's prohibited? You can't do it. The Prophet Muhammad prohibited it very explicitly. And what Osama bin Laden said is, in response to that, is yes, it has been prohibited by the Prophet Muhammad, but it's not set in stone. The law isn't set in stone. That's his argument. Not that, oh, there's a hadith here or a Quranic verse here. No. He says the law isn't set in stone. The only verse of Quran he did bring up was that he said that the Quran says to fight enemies as they fight you. And he said that if America comes into Muslim countries and bombs killing women and children, that in order to stop them from continuing to do this, you retaliate using the same tactic upon them in order to dissuade them from doing so and save Muslim lives. In essence, this is his argument. But of course, he didn't finish the verse of the Quran he quoted, which said that, and do not transgress the limits of Allah. And of course, what would be, so if Allah's saying, fight them as they fight you, but do not transgress Allah's limits, then what limits would they be? Because the only limits in warfare, if you say there is a limit in warfare, the minimum understanding of any kind of limit is that civilians are exempt from being targeted. You can't target civilians. So Osama didn't finish the quote, but his argument is, in essence, is this, if you listen to it. His argument is that because of global oppression and injustice, because of the Muslims being attacked, the Quran merely gives him permission to imitate the West. That's his sunnah. You know, the sunnah is who you imitate. The sunnah of Osama bin Laden is the West. And he cites World War II, the bombing of Dresden, the bombing of, they call it strategic bombing, of German cities with civilians, with had no military value to do so. The attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He cites this as part of his justification for terrorism. So he's not citing the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or some verse in the Quran that said, go out and kill any disbeliever you can find, doesn't exist. What he is citing is, look what the West does, we should do the same. That's his argument. It's not a religious argument. It's not a twist of Islam, because it's not even coming from Islam. It's not even an interpretation of Islam. He's just saying that they attack us, they commit injustice, so there should be reciprocity. And this is a non-Islamic argument and an un-Islamic argument. Now, what do the kind of intelligence agencies say? Right. So the intelligence agencies are responsible for implementing counter-terrorism policies. And the whole point of a counterterrorism policy is to stop terrorism. So these people have to have a clear understanding of the causes of terrorism. More than anyone else, they implement studies to try to find the cause of terrorism. And here's what they say. So Eliza Manningham-Buller, who was the former head of MI5, said, "Our involvement in Iraq, for want of a better word, radicalized a whole generation of young people and spurred some British Muslims to terror." So it wasn't ideology. We see that Arizona State University commissioned a research funded by the Office of Naval Research. They analyzed 2,000 what they called extremist texts between 1988 and 2011. And analyzing all these texts to see what was the justification for terrorism being produced, or what verses of the Quran were being produced in any discourse concerning violence or militancy or terrorism, they said, "We conclude that the verses extremists cite from the Quran do not suggest an aggressive, offensive foe seeking domination and conquest of unbelievers, as is commonly assumed. Instead, they deal with themes of victimization, dishonor, and retribution." So when these terrorists are citing verses of the Quran, they're not citing verses of the Quran that says anything to do with committing an act of violence. They're merely citing a verse of the Quran that they believe reinforces the themes of they're being dishonored, that the Muslims are being attacked, that the Muslims must fight and defend themselves. This is the verses of the Quran they are citing, but these verses of the Quran have nothing to do with attacking civilians or telling people to attack civilians or even conquer non-Muslims at all. This is what the research came up with. But more interestingly, MI5's behavioral science unit, in a leaked report, so this report was not actually meant for public view, it was actually only meant for the internally the government view, and it says something which was quite different to the public narratives which we hear, which I'm going to come to in a bit. And they noticed that the people who use violence or actively support the use of violence are those who tend to be religious novices and are quite far from even being Islamist fundamentalists, quote unquote. So basically, the people who tend to support the use of violence or have or use of terrorism tend to be people who are not religious or even have any understanding or idea of quote-unquote political Islam, and they tend to be people who are not practicing. And this was quite fascinating. And they said that, and this was interesting, and they said that there's no single pathway to violent extremism. They called it violent extremism. There's no single pathway. There is no stereotype or recognizable kind of template. You could say, this person, this person's going to be radicalized into violence. They admit this, and this has been brought up, but the government has never commented on this. The government has never discussed this research, and this is by the MI5. You'd think that of all the research on terrorism, they should be listened to because they're talking about what exactly causes terrorism. And this has been reiterated in many academic studies of radicalization, that it's never any belief of Islam or religiosity of Islam or understanding or indoctrination of any political Islam. It is usually either grievances or that a person is particularly vulnerable mentally to committing violence, or there's certain social or other factors with that person. However, what is being argued now is they say, okay, it might not be ideology that leads to terrorism. Maybe it's not ideology that leads to terrorism. But ideology, quote-unquote, plays a part, is the argument. It is a part of it. Where's the evidence for this? And they say, well, because all Muslim terrorists are Muslim. Well, of course, by definition, if it's the Muslim terrorist, they're going to be... If you call them Muslim, then of course it's circular logic. But there's a more simpler explanation for this. And it's quite simple. There is one thing that Islam does, like every other idea of identity, which is it makes you feel part of a particular group of people. You identify yourself as Muslim. A person who is Irish identifies himself as Irish. A person who is who is African-American identifies himself as African-American. However, what explained the IRA terrorism in Northern Ireland wasn't some particular ideology. What ideology is there, other than the belief that that Ireland should be reunified or unified into one whole. But when Irish people started to feel they were being persecuted by the state, Irish people in Northern Ireland, and mainly Catholics, when they started to feel that they were being persecuted, you saw radicalization into the IRA. They felt that as Irish people, they were being targeted, that they were being discriminated against, and this caused them to be radicalized. Likewise, there was a story, I think a year or two back, when you start seeing these videos of these US police officers shooting African Americans who are just holding their hands up, or they're not being threatening at all, but on the slightest paranoia of the officer himself, they shoot, and there's some very ghastly videos that have come out on this. There was one particular video that came out which was particularly horrific, and right after that video, an African-American man went out with a pistol and shot two police officers. I think a year ago, there was five police officers were shot by an angry African-American man. Is there an ideology behind African-Americans that causes them to do this? Is there some interpretation of African-Americanism that makes them do this? Or is causing this? Are they black supremacists, perhaps? Or some kind of racialist of any particular kind? No. In these cases, everyone concurred that it was anger at the perceived mistreatment of African-Americans that seems to be causing this violence. And those who identify as African-Americans feel that they've personally been targeted, and they are angry. Now, usually this comes out in a mainstream, peaceful movement, which is called Black Lives Matter. Everyone heard of this? Must have heard this. It's a peaceful movement, but there is these people who enact violence. So this shows that terrorism has nothing to do with ideology. Never has. It's got more to do with a variety of factors, more concerning the mentality or the mental state of the individual themselves, rather than any particular ideology. Now I've discussed what is the cause of terrorism. It's very clear that these are issues actually more related to the individuals, and there's a psychology of the individual might be involved there. The idea of grievance and being part of a targeted identity group might be involved there. But some beliefs about what the Muslim world should be, or freedom for the Muslim world in terms of an independent Islamic government or what have you, or a caliphate, these ideas do not lead to particular violence. This is what the security services have said. Now I've discussed that, let's deal with Islamophobia. Does Islamophobia even exist in the UK? And this is important because if we're going to analyse if there's any connection between the two, we have to see what Islamophobia even exists. Well, interestingly, many individuals in the media, one particular person was the political editor of the Daily Mirror, called Jason Beattie. He said, in general, though not exclusively, the portrayal of Muslims in the mainstream media has been unsatisfactory, sloppy, and sometimes stereotypical reporting. It has been noted that in a study of broadsheets between 1994 and 1996, they found, and this is before 9/11, that even back then, 88% of articles on Islam reported Islam as a foreign faith or something different, or British Muslims were linked with the word fundamentalist or fundamentalism. After 9/11 and 7/7, this trend changed considerably. A study commissioned by the Greater London Authority found that in 2007, on average, 91% of articles about Muslims were negative, quote-unquote. A wider Channel 4 Commission survey of British press articles from 2008 found two-thirds of them to portray British Muslims as a threat and a problem, with reference to radical Muslims outnumbering references to quote-unquote moderates 17-1. A number of MPs and a number of other journalists have conceded that the media has become out of control and rampant in its negative portrayal of Muslims. Now, some have even said that this is clearly damaging community cohesion if Muslims are being demonized constantly in the media. Now, here's the thing, and remember this, damaging community cohesion and Islamophobia. If this is a significant problem, what has the UK government said about this, about the media? Have they condemned British media for its excesses? Have they condemned any particular newspapers for their excesses in reporting against Muslims? Because they seem to condemn a whole bunch of individuals, even by name. There was a case that they'd mentioned four popular Muslim speakers in the UK by name, called them extremist. One of them was challenging this in court, Salman Butt. They seem okay to mention names, but why not mention newspapers, Daily Mail or The Sun, perhaps? There's been a lot of controversies regarding their cartoons and being compared to mid-20th century cartoons against another minority from the Middle East originally. And this has not garnered the same kind of reaction from the politicians as Muslims and the practices of the Muslim community has, but I'm going to get to that in a second. Now, what would a connection between Islamophobia and counter-terrorist policies look like? This is the other criteria we have to kind of look into. Because there's Islamophobia, if we have counter-terrorism, we know what it means, the term, but is there any connection between the practice of counter-terrorism policies in the UK and Islamophobia? Well, again, that's something that you're going to have to judge for yourselves, but let's define counter-terrorism first. Let's basically look into what a connection would look like before we then bring out the evidences. So, firstly, counter-terrorism is a concept, when directed only at criminal activity, would of course not be Islamophobic. It's not Islamophobic to stop terrorism. It's actually what Islam would command and judge would be that we should stop terrorism. It's wrong to commit dhulm, to commit oppression, to commit injustice, to target non-combatants. Islam prohibits this unequivocally. So, of course, it's not Islamophobic at all to target terrorism. Whoever's committing terrorism, if they're Muslim, atheist, Jew, Christian, whoever's doing it, they should be stopped. And no, Muslims don't have a problem with this. However, if counter-terrorism policies are aimed solely at preventing people from undertaking acts of terrorism, we would expect it to only focus on those planning it, or those doing it, or those advocating it, or even, maybe, those who perhaps argue or support it, right? Who just argue support it. You could understand that these people would need to be targeted in some way. Those who maybe just support it without doing any actions, maybe they just need to be, you know, dissuaded and their minds changed about it. But those who participate in doing it, planning it, or advocating it openly, or actively recruiting for it, of course they should be stopped. And that's what we would expect from counterterrorism policies, no more, no less. But if counterterrorism policies went beyond that, then there has to be questions asked. Why go beyond targeting who's committing the criminal? The police don't try to find out who thinks in their head that, who might steal in the future. The police don't have a crystal ball. It's not the Minority Report, that old film now, where they can predict the future. They don't do that. They don't have any concern about this. Likewise, if there are people who never intend to break the law or, let's say, commit a theft, the police don't go after them. If the police go after such people who don't commit a crime, but who maybe criticise the police or maybe have a different political view, we'd call it a police state. We'd call it a state that discriminates and is oppressive. That's what we'd call it, and rightfully so. So likewise, counter-terrorism policies, which are enacted by the state security apparatus, if it goes beyond targeting people who are committing acts of terrorism or advocating or supporting it, then we have to ask very important questions. Now, if any component of government-sanctioned counterterrorism policy, or the public rhetoric of politicians discussing counterterrorism, if any of these components were expanded beyond the arena of fighting criminals who perpetrate or advocate a criminal methodology, and instead becomes hostile or prejudicial towards Muslims who merely believe in particular aspects of Islamic belief deemed undesirable by the UK government, then according to the OED definition, this would be Islamophobia. It would be encouraging it, and itself would be Islamophobia. And if the government offered good relations with self-labelled Muslims, only on the condition they renounced any particular belief they had, or a particular aspect of Islam, or a particular interpretation, in order to be compliant with the state ideology of secular liberalism, then this too would be Islamophobia. Even if they say, I have no problem with Muslims. My friend here, he's a Muslim, he doesn't believe in God, but he calls himself a Muslim, I have no problem with him. That was actually turned out. There was the EDL, for example, was one case I like to bring up because they're quite a bombastic group and colourful, to say the least. And they had this member of theirs, EDL member of theirs, called Abdul. And they said, we don't hate Muslims. We have a Muslim member. It's Abdul. Some He's actually a sectarian Scots. Well, he's from Scotland anyway, but he's quite sectarian against Catholics for some strange reason due to Celtic and whatever football teams. Anyway, side point. And so when asked, oh, you know, do you believe in Islam? You believe in God? I said, no, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in Islam. But I was born a Muslim background. And I call myself Muslim. And that's the type of Muslim the EDL are happy with. So does Abdul refute any allegations that the EDL are Islamophobic? No, because you see, Muslims are not a race. We're not an ethnicity. If you believe in Islam and the beliefs of Islam, the articles of faith, you're a Muslim. If you don't believe in them, by definition, you wouldn't be a Muslim, even if you called yourself a Muslim. Right? I mean, I could call this chair a donkey because it has four legs, and donkey has four legs, but it's not a donkey. So anyone who calls themselves any label, and they don't fit the description or definition, then of course it wouldn't be accepted. I could call myself a secular liberal, but people will look at my beliefs and say, "But you're not secular liberal. You don't believe in X, Y, and Z number of things." I could call myself a communist, and people would say, "Well, no, Abdullah, because you clearly reject these articles of these very basic premises of communism. So you can't be called that." So if you don't believe in God, and you say you're a Muslim, well, that doesn't mean that person's a Muslim just because they call themselves a Muslim. I give an example. Would it not be veganophobic to say, I don't hate vegans, I only hate vegans who don't eat meat, but I have no problem with the ones who do eat meat? And would it still be veganophobic if they respond, I have a friend who calls himself a vegan, but he eats meat, proving that you don't have to abstain from meat in order to be vegan, so I don't have a problem with that kind of veganism, and I don't have a problem with vegans. That wouldn't be a person who's tolerant to vegans, just because he has someone who calls himself a vegan, but then eats meat, which then automatically invalidates you being vegan. So this is the issue. So now, in order for us to judge whether Western counterterrorism policies are actually Islamophobic or encouraging Islamophobia, and I'm not referring to the ones that are dealing with the criminals, I'm dealing with the policies that go beyond dealing with the criminals and go beyond and deal with things with people who are not criminals. Are they Islamophobic? Well, let's have a look. When 9/11 happened, America called its war a war on terror, but not a war on Al-Qaeda. Why didn't they call themselves a war? Why didn't they call it a war on Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda attacked America. So then America should respond and declare war on Al-Qaeda. Why say a war on terror? You can't fight a methodology. You can fight people. You can't fight methodology. Likewise, well, the UK, when it was fighting the IRA, many politicians would say they're at war with the IRA. They're fighting the IRA. They wouldn't say they're fighting terror, per se. Just this nebulous word. No, not nebulous word, but just it's not a particular group. Terrorism is just a word. It's not a group or people of individuals. So they will say, well, we're at war with the IRA until something gets resolved there. And here's the problem. The problem was brought in when this war on terror was declared, and it was discussed that the ideology of these terrorists are what is being fought against, not the terrorists themselves. Now, that might sound innocuous. It's fine. Yeah, we'll fight terrorists. We fight their ideology must be evil as well. But then look at that. So let's say, let's take the KKK, for example. Let's say we want to fight against the KKK. If we say we must fight against the KKK and fight against their ideology, people would agree. But if I say their ideology is, for example, the belief that Jesus is God or the Trinity, because they're Christians, KKK are Christians. People say, wait, one second. That's not an ideology specific to the KKK. This is just Christianity. There's something else. You're going, this is beyond the remit here of fighting the KKK. You're now moving it to Christianity. And rightfully so. Now, the war on terror, fine. Even it's a good idea to say, okay, we can fight against terrorism. That's a good idea. But if George Bush, for example, used rhetoric like, we have to defeat political ambitions of extremists, they want an Islamic government, they want to have a caliphate, and we have to defeat these ideas and ideologies, well, then here's the problem here. Because, you see, while Muslims all rightfully condemn Al-Qaeda, and we condemn their methodologies, but Muslims believe in Sharia, they believe in the Quran, they believe that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam instituted a form of government to protect the Muslims and advance the cause of Islam and to protect Islamic interests, implement Islamic law, which was caliphate. The first caliph was Abu Bakr, then Umar, then Uthman, then Ali. Are these extremists? The first four caliphs? Only 100 years ago, the UK was having diplomatic relations with a caliphate, which was the Ottoman caliphate. Were they extremists? Was that, were they a whole bunch of extremists? And considering that at the time it was incontrovertible that Muslims viewed, most Muslims, to be fair, viewed the Uthmani Caliph as the Caliph, as the Emir al-Mu'mineen, the leader of the Muslims, then obviously if you say that the idea of a Caliph or Caliphate itself is extremist and should be fought against, you've now moved beyond fighting a war on terrorism, and you're now fighting a war on aspects of Islam that have been there for 1,400 years. And they're not violent aspects of Islam. It's a peaceful aspect of Islam. Accountable government, ruling of justice, pluralism, Christians and Jews and Yazidis all having a right to life, their right to religious practice, a right to worship as they see fit, no one to coerce them, no one to oppress or persecute them. This was what the Ottoman Caliphate did, and this is what obviously the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ advocated. But to declare, as George Bush did, that the fight is against an ideology that believes in caliphate or believes in Islamic government, this was now going beyond just fighting against terrorists. It was in 2009, it was leaked by Whitehall, this Contest 2, Contest was the counterterrorism strategy in the UK, and it was leaked, a part of it which discussed what would be extremist ideas. It had a number of points. Anyone who advocates a caliphate or pan-Islamic state encompassing many countries, anyone who promotes Sharia law, anyone who argues that Islam bans homosexuality and that is a sin against God, people who believe in jihad or armed resistance. These concepts, I mean, it probably consider many most Catholics to be also extremists, as well as many Protestant Christians as well to be extremists by these definitions. But this was now a counter-terrorism policy going beyond attacking the criminals and going into areas of belief which do not predispose people to violence per se. And of course, the intelligence agencies have noted this, that these ideas don't predispose people to violence. So why are you now going after these issues that have nothing to do with violence? Then we see the rhetoric coming from UK government ministers. So we see David Cameron, who argued that they have to get to the root of the problem of terrorism. And they have to be absolutely clear, and I'll quote, where the origins of where these terrorist attacks lie. That is the existence of an ideology, Islamist extremism. We should be equally clear what we mean by this term, and we must distinguish it from Islam. Islam is a religion observed peacefully and devoutly by over a billion people. Islamist extremism is a political ideology. He then mentions their ultimate goal is an entire Islamist realm governed by an interpretation of Sharia. Move along the spectrum and you find people who may reject violence, but who accept various parts of the extremist worldview, including real hostility towards Western democracy and liberal values. It is vital that we make this distinction between religion on one hand and political ideology on the other. Why is David Cameron discussing what is and what isn't part of a religion? And why is he even going to areas which are just discussing different political concepts or different political ideas or philosophies? What relevance do these things have to fighting terrorism? In fact, if a Muslim believes that a independent elected caliph is an obligation in Islam, would David Cameron consider them to be enemies now that must be targeted, that they follow, in one case, a quote-unquote, a poisonous ideology? And who is the British government to decide what is or isn't religion, or part of a religion? It's meant to be a secular government. When secularists go to the Muslim world and they say, secularism is the best system, secularism will bring peace, secularism will allow plurality, they always say, because secularism doesn't get involved in people's religion. It doesn't involve itself in a community's religious practices or what they choose to believe or what doctrines they choose to adopt. And yet you have David Cameron discussing, as part of counter-terrorism policy, the need to declare parts of in essence, Islam to be not Islam, and parts of Islam to be, which presumably are just to do with ritualized prayers and things. Oh, that's acceptable Islam. And interestingly enough, he mentioned, this is all in his Munich speech, by the way. He mentioned on that, he also mentioned the far right. And he said, on the one hand, those on the hard right ignore this distinction between Islam and Islamist extremism, and just say that Islam and the West are irreconcilable, that there is a clash of civilizations. So it follows we should cut ourselves off from this religion, whether that is through forced repatriation, favoured by some fascists, or banning of new mosques, as is suggested in some parts of Europe. These people fuel Islamophobia, and I completely reject their argument. So his argument is that the difference really between the hard right and David Cameron, presumably, is that he believes the West and Islam are reconcilable, but the hard right don't believe Islam and the West are reconcilable. And if you don't believe they're reconcilable, then what follows naturally, apparently, is you have to implement a whole bunch of measures that limit Islam or limit the Muslim practice. And then he gets to the most interesting part. He says, now I'm not saying that issues of poverty and grievance about foreign policy are not important. Yes, of course we must tackle them. These are just contributory factors. Even if we sorted out all the problems that I believe I have mentioned, and you're referring to the poverty and grievance over foreign policy, there would still be terrorism. I believe the root lies in the existence of this extremist ideology. I would argue an important reason so many young Muslims are drawn to it comes to a question of identity. And then after the publication of the counter-extremism strategy last year, he mentioned that it is a concern for many that some Muslims hold a loyalty to a greater community than the national boundaries, to the Ummah, the Islamic international community, than just their national communities. So this concern that Muslims, some Muslims, are not loyal or that they have a loyalty greater than that of the British government. And what was even more interesting and a little hilarious was when this description that people who don't believe in the rule of law are extremists, according to the Prevent strategy, have nothing to do with preventing terrorism, why it's going into this discussion. And it was interesting because the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, when he was discussing with an MP, an MP said that anyone basically who believes that God or God's will or their religious law is greater than the law of England are an extremist. And then Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said, well, then you have an extremist right here because I believe that the law of God is greater than the laws of man. But of course, it wasn't targeting the Anglican Church, and the Anglican Church weren't really the focus of this. And this comes up in the discussions of many members of the current government. So in one particular, and I'll kind of just finish on some of these quotations that I think you need to kind of listen to. So William Shawcross, the head of the Charity Commission, who's put into that position, head of the Charity Commission, obviously conservative with the Conservative Party, and he mentioned in a lecture when he was delivering while discussing a book that he published, he said, Europe and Islam is one of the greatest, most terrifying problems of our future. I think all European countries have vastly, very quickly growing Islamic populations. David Cameron has said rhetoric such as, to deny Islamic extremism has anything to do with Islam means you disempower the critical reforming voices. And this also brings to the RAND Corporation's report in 2003, the biggest think tank in the United States that advises the American government, that says that as part of the war on terror, the means to achieve victory, in essence, or to the end goal, should be encouraging a reformation of Islam. Now, I mentioned a few evidences, and I'm going to bring the lecture here to the close, but with this kind of rhetoric, which says, on one side, Islam and Islamism is separate, however, Islam needs to be reformed, and you can't deny that Islam has a connection, terrorism is in some way, or Islamic extremism is in some way connected to Islam, this kind of rhetoric is what the media hears. It's what the public hear, and it reports it. The media gets its headlines from a lot of the quotations by these politicians. Even during the Labour government, Jack Straw, he discussed about maybe the niqab being banned in certain contexts. And there were immediately after that reports of Muslim women being attacked. In one case, a Muslim woman had her hijab, she was threatened while she was wearing hijab. She'd take it off, Jack Straw said so. Now, of course, that's anecdotal. But if you see that in many of the reports coming out, especially the Casey report now has just come out a week ago, which discussed, and it mentioned and it highlighted very specifically that Muslims, more than any other ethnic group, is a particular concern regarding integration into society. And it also mentioned that, yes, the Muslim community is facing a lot of pressure at the moment from wider society, but once it deals with certain issues within itself, this pressure should ease. No mention of, we need to tell the media to stop sensationalizing against them. Or we don't see the politician saying that it is the media sensationalism which is causing the breakdown of community cohesion by targeting Muslims and demonizing Muslims or portraying negative stories of Muslims. Now, put all this together, Obviously, we see David Cameron, he's interested in Muslim loyalty to the UK, integration, assimilation, and connecting that to counter-terrorism policies, even though it has no relation to counter-terrorism policies, should have no connection to it. Taking into account all this evidence and more, which time has, would not allow me to continue, and I could go on, maybe the QA I could mention for bits and bobs. But taking into account all this evidence, I ask you to answer this question for yourself. Does certain counter-terrorism policies have a connection to, encourage, or even themselves are Islamophobic in any way, or encourage Islamophobia in any way? I think that's the question I'll leave you to answer. And if any of you have any contentions or with that, then please bring up in the Q&A and we can discuss it. Thank you for listening. So any questions, answers, comments, contentions? I'm happy to take contentions too. You don't have to accept everything I've said blindly. Any points? Shall I? If you're not going to mention, maybe I'll get the ball rolling with just discussing some historical context. Now, if you do happen to believe that the UK government has some hostility to aspects of Islam or prejudices to aspects of Islam, which have been mainstream Islamic discourse for 1,400 years, know that it is not due to some kind of cosmic hatred of Islam or a cosmic war against Islam in that sense. It's actually more germane factors, because any historian here, if you look back in UK history, you'll see that this is not the first time that such a situation has happened in UK. Just a few hundred years ago, maybe 300 years ago, and continuing up until the 19th century, the Catholics of the UK suffered similar stigmas, very similar discriminations. Catholics were suspected of being violent, of suspected of trying to take over this country, to apply the Catholic canon law on this country and usurp the throne. Catholics were obviously linked to terror attacks. Of course, there were terror attacks that Catholics had done, like Guy Fawkes, which, of course, is behind the 5th of November commemoration. The Great Fire of London was blamed on the Catholic. Admittedly, the Catholic came out and admitted that he did it, but people think that it was just owning up to advance the political cause. And the cause was usually against the persecution of Catholics. So the persecution of Catholics, as many historians have posited, was a radicalizing factor in Catholicism. But some people will say, no, it's a Catholicism, or as they used to call it, papism. It was their Islamism for their time, papism, that pejorative word. They say that papism leads to violence. The Pope, the belief in the Pope as greater than the British crown is subversive, it's seditious, you can't trust Catholics, they want to take over this country or depose the monarch. And of course, in foreign relations, England sometimes had wars with Catholic countries, and there was the whole Protestant Catholic conflict. So Catholics faced laws, perhaps the first prevent laws, where they were told that they have to swear allegiance to the monarch, they have to denounce the Pope. But to a Catholic, belief in the Pope as the head of your church is part and parcel of their creed. It defines a Catholic. They're told to renounce. I mean, arguably, it was probably said that we don't hate all Catholics, as long as the Catholics that renounce the Pope, we have no problem with. But then does that make them Catholic anymore? But they had to do so. There was the Catholic testing laws, where Catholics basically obviously had to make this test. They had to make an oath of allegiance. And they were denied positions in government and certain professions. They weren't allowed to get jobs in those professions. In some cases, they weren't allowed to inherit and so on. There's many discriminatory laws against Catholics, which only stopped around about the mid-19th century, when the geostrategic situation or geopolitical situation changed and Catholicism was no longer a force in the world. Secular governments kind of arose and the church was spent force. Then Catholics could be trusted because the Pope is harmless now. And that's what was the perceived. But the Catholics were also maligned, suspected, and the same arguments used against Catholics, well, actually quite literally the same arguments used against Catholics were used against Muslims even back then. So you had both John Locke and John Milton, considered to be the grandfather of free speech. John Milton argued that you can't basically, he called it popery, you must basically first invite them to leave their religion or leave this belief in the Pope. If they don't, then you can be justified in exterminating people that do so, because the Pope, belief in the Pope was argued by John Milton in his Areopagitica, that it exterminates all civil government. And so so these people can't be tolerated because they have an intolerant belief, a belief that the Pope is greater than government. And then he mentioned the belief similar to that of the Mohammedans as well, actually, ironically enough. John Locke also made the same argument in his ironically titled A Letter on Toleration. Although he interestingly did argue that religion doesn't cause violence. He says oppression causes violence. John Locke argued that it's actually oppression that causes violence, not religion. But Catholics potentially could be not tolerated because if they believe in a higher power than the government, how could they be trusted? Also, interestingly enough, John Locke said that Mohammedans also could be distrusted and might not have an argument to be tolerated because they believe in following the rulings of the Sheikh of Islam, who is under the thrall of the Ottoman Caliph, which they believe is greater than any other government. So maybe you could tolerate Muslims for that, for the same reason as well. So these kind of discussions and this concern, which you see William Shawcross and actually a whole number of other individuals say things which are quite similar, is not because people woke up one morning and said, I hate Islam, or it's a cosmic battle between the West and Islam, or it's the Crusades part two. No, none of that. It's more germane, actually, and it's a repeating historical problem, which is mistrusting minorities because they have either a different religious beliefs in particular, different practices or laws, or beliefs that have a political aspect to them, which are viewed to be incompatible with a supposedly loyal subject, whatever however you define that. Anyway, so I think I'll answer this point in case anyone wants to argue. Are you just saying that the government hates Islam just because it wants to hate Islam, or it's part of a crusade? Or no, none of that. If you look into history, you see the same repetition of the same kind of arguments. Winston Churchill wrote a tract called, I believe it was Jews versus Bolshevism, I believe was the title. I forget the exact title of it, but please Google Winston Churchill, Bolshevism, Jews. Winston Churchill made the same argument. He said, national Jews, you can trust them. They are people who are loyal to the country. But international Jews, they follow Bolshevism, which is the communists, so on. And they seem to be disproportionately leading communist movements. And these are the issues that the British Jews have to combat. The same kind of silly, scaremongering, xenophobic rhetoric and arguments you see today about political ideologies, about minorities and their loyalties being tested, whether there's a fringe of them or a majority of them. This stuff has happened and repeated throughout history, and it has to, obviously, we have to learn from history at some point, stop repeating these silly persecutions of minorities or distrusts of minorities, because obviously both the Catholics and the Jews and Muslims are humans like anybody else. We want to believe in our beliefs. We don't want to be persecuted, but we don't want to be discriminated against. And we certainly mean no ill will to any of the countries that we reside in. So people should stop distrusting us and stop interfering with our religious beliefs and telling us what is acceptable religion and what is not acceptable religion, because that's the problem. Any questions, points of contention? I think there's a brother up there. Yep.
You speak about identity, things like this. But if we look, do you think there's a big link between the UK foreign policy and why some Muslims might be disintegrated from society here? So, for example, the mistake of going into Iraq, the apparent mistake of Syria in 1915, Palestine. So, I think it's natural maybe for a Muslim to feel not very connected or to have national pride with such a government. Actually, I think it might be much more complicated.
Well, I've mentioned that it's not religion that radicalizes people, and it's not grievances or foreign policy grievances themselves that cause some people to commit violence. What many studies have shown is that there's a particular mentality which is vulnerable to, or susceptible, or prone to committing violence, and these particular mentalities are everywhere in every religion, every ethnicity, every nationality, every ideology. As I mentioned earlier in my discussion, you have mainstream political movements like the suffragists, who were peaceful, political, campaigning, and so on. Then you have the militant fringe of them. Likewise, obviously, with the African-American civil rights movement, you had the mainstream political movement, peaceful movement, and then you had a fringe militant movement. So, but I'll point like this. One clear example of this is the Republic of Ireland. Republic of Ireland has a neutral foreign policy. How many Islamic terror attacks have happened in the Republic of Ireland? Does anyone know? Sir? Anyone? Can't think of a number? So, zero. Zero attacks. There is a sizable Muslim population in South American countries, In one particular country, it's almost 30%. In South America, how many Islamic terror attacks against civilians, against the population of South American people, have happened in South America? Sorry? Guess a number. You're right. Yeah, exactly, zero. So surely then people would notice there is a correlation between foreign policy grievances, because South America is not involved in the Muslim world in terms of foreign policies. Republic of Ireland is neutral. Switzerland, too, is also neutral. How many terror attacks have happened in Switzerland? Again, zero. But what George Bush argued during his war on terror is, he said that these people, these terrorists, they are fighting us because of our way of life. They want to destroy us. They want to destroy our way of life. Same with the kind of hyperbole we hear from David Cameron and his successor. They said that this is the greatest fight of our generation. It's like the world wars. All this hyperbole and rhetoric, which what does it make the average English person or British person feel, is that they're under war. That there are Muslims who are out to get them for no other crime other than that they just exist. Of course, how are they going to react to Muslims then? With suspicion. They're going to be worried. Because the politicians are not telling the people why is terrorism really happening. And even Osama bin Laden actually responded to that. He said that, well, if that's... He said, you say I attack you for your freedom, then please explain why I don't attack Sweden. Right, this is what Osama bin Laden said in his response. But that being said, and I'll make this caveat very clear, I don't have to, but because giving this topic as a Muslim with the media out there, you always get suspected. There is no justification in any way, shape or form for terrorism under any circumstance. And one of the beautiful things I like about Islam is that because we believe that Islam comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we believe that the laws and prohibitions of Islam are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we as Muslims, if you fear God, you cannot break the laws, even if you think it's in your benefit to do so. And this is very interesting, because for Muslims would not, if there was an Islamic government, they would not drop nuclear bombs onto Hiroshima or Nagasaki. They would not firebomb Dresden, burning to death 30,000 men, women, and children, burning to death. Or those who escaped in the shelters were cooked in like ovens. Right? Islam would prohibit this. But secular liberal philosophers have argued, like John Rawls and Michael Walzer. John Rawls is one of the most preeminent political philosophers of secular liberalism, or the most preeminent in recent time. Anyone here study politics or political science, or they call it political science? No. So, you do? Law and international relations. Have you heard of John Rawls? No, okay. And they argued for what they call the supreme emergency exemption. They said that if the state or society is under threat, if its existence is under threat, and it will bring it victory, it can have an exemption from the prohibition against targeting civilians. It can target civilians. Michael Walzer brings up World War II as his example, you know, bombing German civilians. And I think that's disgusting. I think that's absolutely disgusting. But I often wonder, I say, well, how does the counterterrorism expert, not even experts, these pundits or these rhetoric on counterterrorism, how do they expect to stop terrorism by telling Muslims they should become secular liberal when the formal secular liberal philosophers justify terrorism, and Islam doesn't in any way, shape or form? And Osama bin Laden admitted that he was copying the West. It wasn't the Prophet Muhammad told him to do so. He was emulating the Prophet Muhammad. He didn't say that. He says he's just copying the West, which I think is a horrific and un-Islamic argument in the extreme. Imam Qurtubi, a classical Islamic scholar, discussed this. He discussed this particular instance. What if Muslim civilians are being targeted, are being killed? Specifically, what can Muslims do? Can they retaliate in like manner? And here's what he said. He said, it is not permissible for us to retaliate in the same manner, even if they kill our women and children and cause sorrow to befall us. It is not permissible for us to act likewise with the intention of making them feel grief and sorrow. And this is what I love about Islam, that we hold ourselves to a higher criteria, a higher standard than what is beneficial or not beneficial, materially speaking. People say, oh, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we bombed it because it ended the war quicker. And the argument is whether it would end the war quicker or not. I say, it doesn't matter. It's still wrong. It was still wrong. How can you even justify it? It's disgusting. How comes Winston Churchill is revered as a model English hero when he initiated the strategic bombing of German civilians? How is that acceptable? How is that praised? And that's why I love about Islam is that there's no exceptions. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prohibited something and has given no exceptions, then Muslims, we hold fast to it. So I can confidently say that Osama bin Laden is going against Islam, not because I disagree with his interpretation, it's because he doesn't have an interpretation of Islam. His only argument is that in the modern world, Muslims can imitate the West. And we say, I reject that. And that is the real reason. But yet, counter-terrorism policy is based on the idea that terrorism derives from an Islamic-related ideology, in the words of David Cameron. It's connected in some way to Islam. How is it connected to Islam? When Osama bin Laden says, cite as his justification, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, how is Hiroshima or now Nagasaki connected to Islam or an Islamic argument? Or from the Quran? I looked in the Quran, nowhere about Hiroshima and Nagasaki or dropping nuclear weapons. So Osama bin Laden he's not even distorting Islam, he's just not, his argument is not even from Islam in the first place. So then why are counter-terrorism policies going beyond just targeting criminals and targeting people who believe in common Islamic concepts such as Islamic government, Sharia, the idea of a caliphate, which 100 years ago Britain was having diplomatic relations with, the Ottoman caliphate? How are these extremist ideas now that must be tackled? And why is it that David Cameron mentions the problem here is identity, and the problem here is that there are some Muslims who have a loyalty greater than their nationality? That is a question you have to ask yourself. Is this in the realm of Islamophobia now? Does this argument encourage Islamophobia? You better. Okay, so the brother asked, do I think that the government's silence on the media attacks on Islam or Muslims or the portrayal of Muslims is because they approve? Well, obviously, I can't go into their head and determine whether they approve or not of it. However, all I'll just say is they know it exists. There was a committee set up, I think it was called the Anti-Muslim Hate Group, I believe, to investigate these matters and to obviously discuss with media. But there was a report from one of the members of it, one of the key members of this group, who left it, resigned from it, and said this group does not have any real intention or not serious about combating anti-Muslim hate in the media and so on. He almost seemed like a token gesture to him. It was a token gesture. His words, a member that was in this group. So I forget his name. I'll probably find it somewhere here, actually. So then how is it... So all I'm going to say is the government knows of this. People have raised the issue that that the portrayal of Muslims in the media has caused a breakdown of community cohesion, the attacks, the negative portrayals. So if the government have been serious about community cohesion, and they go on about community cohesion all the time, especially when it comes to extremism and combating it in the name of protecting community cohesion, why not the media? So I don't have a crystal ball. I can't see into their minds. I think that question is best addressed to them. But look at the evidences and see for yourself what you think is likely. Sister in the front.
Well, two questions really. We know that some members and the Saudi decision took the case of prevents the Supreme Court of what is last going to ask, what are your thoughts on this and how do you foresee possible changes to these policies in the future?
Okay. Sorry, let me just okay, so because my memory is sometimes Swiss cheese, the individual who was part of the all-parliamentary group on Islamophobia is Dr. Chris Allen, with two L's, and in E, A-L-L-E-N. He wrote an article, it was published, I believe, in the Huffington Post, saying, why I quit the government's anti-Muslim hatred working group. Read his comments, he's a member of the group, of that group, read his comments for yourself. So you're not just taking my word for it. So I've given you the reference. Dr. Chris Allen, he's also a lecturer in social policy at the University of Birmingham. Anyway, so to get to your question, sister. So could you repeat the second part of that?
So it just comes to mind that changes are possible or that it can be challenged to a certain extent. So how do you sort of
do I think counterterrorism policies can be changed through debate? Well, the thing is that, in theory, yes, of course. If we get enough public opinion on our side to challenge this, to expose it for what it is, then of course. And there's many academics have come out and scrutinized this the prevent policy and scrutinized aspects of it that they deem to be extraneous. So like, what's this got to do with preventing terrorism? And the conveyor belt theory, which believes that religion or ideas or a particular interpretation of religion or something is linked to violence, has been completely debunked by almost all mainstream academics. It's discounted. as a theory, the conveyor belt theory, but it's still being used by government, despite in the face of all this academic research. And it's interesting because usually when the government cites a study which proves something, it says this has been proven or demonstrated. But when it, in discussing the concept of radicalization, it says we judge, use the word we judge, that radicalization is due to ideology and extremism. We judge. Well, thanks for your opinion, but this is a report that about, no, this is a policies that will affect people, and we have to go by objective measurement, not your judgment, which can be dubious or might have a dubious motive, which is more to do with assimilation of a minority into the into UK than terrorism, or questions about loyalty, or changing practices deemed to be illiberal, and instead promoting a liberal reformed Islam. Well, if you believe that Islam should be reformed, then clearly you concede at the very least that you are Islamophobic to the unreformed Islam. That concedes at the very least that you're phobic to the unreformed Islam. Or it would at least be an evidence for that. And I would say that so security officials have to challenge that, and they do, but it really needs an immediate groundswell. I can only assume that the gentleman at the top of it is a member of the police, I believe. You're not? Security of some kind?
University security.
Okay. If you remember the police, I was going to say that it's people like you that have to report upwards and get these, like, popularize these ideas. But as a member of the public, you obviously, as, like everybody else, you all have a duty to ensure that government policy is informed by fact and evidence, not by a particular type of right-wing agenda or an understanding of immigration which might be potentially xenophobic. Right? So inshallah, Salman Butt will challenge in court. We'll see what the court, you know, what the court says. Obviously, the courts are interesting because courts require evidence and not just opinion. So it'll be fascinating to see where that goes. And then if he does win, it'll be fascinating to see what the government, how it reacts to that. But predictably, it'll probably react by trying to get around these judgments or try to find another way of calling people extremists. Because the word extremist has no meaning in of itself. It doesn't mean anything. How can you define it? And I know the government in the prevent policy put up definitions such as if you make vocal opposition to democracy, so you criticize democracy. Well, there are people in this country who are monarchists. They believe that, you know, go back to the good old times, the monarchy is a good thing. Are they extremists now? The Jehovah's Witnesses, I think it's Jehovah's Witnesses, I believe so. They don't believe in voting because they believe that this is the government of this world and therefore the government of the next world, and they don't get involved in the political process. I think Jehovah's Witnesses, I believe, I have to double check that, or not a denomination of Christianity, but there's a particular sect that doesn't do it. But no one has a go at them. No one says, oh, look, they're not engaging. Oh, look, they are counter to our values, because it's accepted. Justin Welby believes in a higher law than the rule of law, as in the rule of man-made law. He believes in God's law, or that, you know, obviously God has a higher say than Parliament MPs and House of Lords. And he himself said, well, they call me extremist because I believe that. But he won't be called an extremist. No one's going to call him an extremist. The government won't treat him as an extremist. And why is that? Question that you have to ask yourselves. I'm not going to lead you with leading answers. Just ask yourself these questions. Why is he not considered extremist? And if you say, well, this rule of law idea, you know, it's not serious, but why is it in the prevent counterterrorism policy as part of countering terrorism? What's that got to do with counterterrorism? And that's why I say that these issues have to be raised. So, inshallah, maybe we can challenge it if we get enough public support. But against the tidal wave of negative media, mostly right-wing, the right-leaning media, it's very difficult, and the government doesn't seem to, well, hasn't said anything about it, so we'll see. But we have to try our best. All of us have to try our best to communicate the truth as much as possible. Any other questions, contentions, or anything you disagree with? Obviously, don't feel compelled to agree with everything I say. Your brother?
Just quickly, what do you feel is the biggest incentive for governments to use counter-terrorism policies to incite Islamophobia? If you were to pinpoint one reason, why Islam?
Okay, so why... If the British government was using counterterrorism policies to incite Islamophobia, I haven't said that, but if it did, what would be a motivation for that? Yeah, and that's quite interesting because that's a big section unto itself. All I'll say is this: there was some academic studies done about the perception of Muslims and the policies towards Muslims and Islam prior to 9/11. This is prior to 9/11, and these academics used the term anti-Muslim or anti-Muslimness. Was their terms. And they said it follows two kinds. You have domestic anti-Muslimness, and you have strategic anti-Muslimness. So strategic anti-Muslimness is, according to these academics, that when a policy is aligned to prevent or undermine particular governments or enact strategies countering political aspects or manifestations of Islam. So, for example, the Iranian Revolution in 1979 was viewed as a turning point in American foreign policy to the Middle East, in shifting it from just communism and dealing with tin pot secular dictators to now dealing with a country that ostensibly calls itself Islamic and wants to preach Islamic revolution. And of course, the 1973 oil embargo over the 1973 war with Israel, when the Saudi Arabia, many Muslim countries, put an oil embargo on the United States, also created this change of policy. That's what they call it, a strategic anti-Muslimness. Domestic anti-Muslimness, they say, is usually as a reaction to immigration and assimilation of minorities into host populations. So he points out these two particular motivations. But even if we look at in history, even if we go back 100 years ago, let's go back 100 years ago, the architect of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, the one that cut the Middle East up into all the map it looks today, it wasn't the Sykes-Picot particular treaty, it was one that came after that, but this was their first particular foray into it. So Mark Sykes said in August 1917, he says that regarding UK interest, he says, "I want to see a permanent Anglo-French entente alliance, allied to Jews, Arabs and Armenians, which will render pan-Islamism innocuous, i.e. neutralized, and protect Africa from the Turco-German combine." He also said in 1915 to the British cabinet on the Middle East, he said that the reduction of the Ottoman Caliphate is necessary to defeat the malignant power of political pan-Islam. And then he said, to defeat the enemy is essential to destroy the Ottoman Empire. So at that time, now when they use the word Islamism, just so you understand, it isn't because they had the same understanding back then. Back then, the word Islamism was synonymous with Islam. There was no separate Islamism and Islam. Because Islamism is the first word for Islam, invented by Voltaire, after Mohammedanism got rid of. So when they use the word Islamism, they mean Islam, and you see it used commonly. But I think, I won't go into that story so much, though, but due to certain circumstances of people who were doing translations and Muslims who were complaining about being called Mohammedans, they said, okay, fine, we'll use the word, the Arabic word for it. But generally, they would have just kept the word Islamism, which is why Judaism and Hinduism still kept the ism. That was the way of naming religions, ism. You put the ism at the end. It just means the beliefs and practices of Islam. Islamism means the belief and practices of Islam. And Judaism, Hinduism is the same concept. Anyway, I digress. But we see back then, these were the same discussions. I've got loads and loads of quotations from back then of British foreign policy towards Ottoman state, but towards the later part, because the Ottoman caliphs were using the idea of political pan-Islam to incite rebellion against the British in India and alliance with the Germans, the British saw that the understanding of a pan-Islam, and Islam uniting multiple lands around the world, was dangerous, and the Ottoman Empire represented the epicenter of it, and so should be deposed. But it wasn't because they always hated Ottoman Empire per se, it was just expedient for so, and because obviously oil resources in the Middle East, as they've admitted. But prior to that, in the 19th century, Britain supported the Ottoman Caliphate against the Russians in the Crimean War, primarily because if it collapses too quickly, they were worried that Russia would get the lion's share of the territories, so they wanted to keep it propped up as much as possible because they were too far from it. It's a different discussion. But geostrategic considerations are mostly the issue. The British government, as Kenneth Clark said when asked, look, why don't we make negotiations and allow the Middle East to have maybe some kind of Islamic government? You made a negotiation with the IRA, so why not have a negotiation to have non-interference or just come to some accommodation? And he said, well, look, unlike the IRA, who believed in basically secular concepts like nationalism, there is no negotiation on the possibility of a caliphate. That's what Kenneth Clark said, the Labour minister at the time, when Labour was in government. So this is more to do with British government strategic policies, as well as the age-old concern over domestic policy, domestic assimilation of a minority whose loyalty is suspected. These would be the motivations if they were British, if they were anti-terror policies, which were Islamophobic. I happen to say they are, but if they are, then these would probably be the most likely motivations. If they are, if the brother up there had a question.
It seems like the British government are not discontent with removing Islamic political ambitions, but rather changing Islam quite fundamentally. Is it due to fear of an Islamic caliphate arising again, which would effectively reduce or interfere with their interests internationally?
Okay, it's a good question. I'll cite you an interesting quote from Lord Cromer, who was the British governor of British-occupied Egypt in 1900s. Egypt was occupied before the Ottomans fell. He said, it's very interesting, he said, it is absurd to suppose Europe will look on as a passive spectator whilst a retrograde government based purely on Mohammedan principles and Oriental ideas is established in Egypt. The material interests at stake are too important. The new generation of Egyptians has to be persuaded or forced into imbibing the true spirit of Western civilization. That was 100 years ago, that quotation. But I don't think British foreign policy has changed so much with regards to the Middle East since back then. And I bring you the quotations because, firstly, we should all scrutinize claims that are made. You have to know where these claims come from, if there's evidence for it, it's not just someone ranting or making an argument. And secondly, because the criticism against mentioning this is that it's a conspiracy theory, or these are just arguments brought up inciting irrational hate. So look, no one needs to be hated in this, other than policies, other than government policies. And in a country which claims to be free, you should be allowed to hate or dislike government policy and criticize government policy, otherwise you're in a dictatorship. Right? So I think Muslims should understand that the situation that government UK foreign policy throughout history, especially in the Middle East, since the fall of the Ottoman Caliphate, or even before that, has not held the best interests out for Muslims and is more concerned with their own financial or economic interests or strategic interests, projecting power and controlling, being able to have influence. They play a game of Monopoly, but it's over the world, unfortunately, owning control and so on and so forth of oil fields and such and such. I mean, Tony Blair said, oh, if we only wanted oil from Iraq, we would just do a deal with Saddam Hussein. People pointed out, well, no, it's not to get oil, it's to control the supply of the oil, or to have a government which can be easily influenced or directed to fulfill your interests. And that's the situation that I could argue we find. Certainly was the situation on the first governments in the Middle East after colonialism, when they gained independence. We have British ministers talking about creating a facade of self-rule, but it would be British controlled from within. Not conspiracy, the British ministers in their cables. The cables have been declassified because they're so old, but historians read it for themselves and they say that this was the situation. The British protectorate of Iraq wasn't an independent Iraq, right? And what happened, and the King Hussein afterwards wasn't an independent king. These were all governments that were there, which were, as the politicians themselves admitted, were there to give a facade of self-rule while permitting UK to have its interests satisfied, because it costs too much money to have an occupation army in another country and people don't like it there. But if you can get people that are from the natives to occupy it for on behalf of you, well, then it's easier. It's much more cost efficient. It's just good economic practices if all you care about is economics. So I would say that a caliphate would certainly be not something which would benefit to the same degree economically certain Western powers as they are getting now from the governments in the Middle East, because a caliphate, presumably with Muslims implementing Islam and thinking about independence and thinking about developing Islam, would use the oil to build up their own industry. You know, some people said, I had a debate with an Iraqi politician. He said, look, we have to sell it. We make money out of selling it. So what would you do different? Because it's coming out of the ground. We have to sell it and make money. So how would you do anything different? And I asked him, what do you think America does with the oil? Does it set it on someone else? It uses it. It built up its entire industry on these natural resources. That's why it can then... And then it will sell you its produced goods used with your oil at a higher rate back to you, because you never developed your own industry. You just sold your resources off. See, we don't think ahead. We don't think in a more enlightened way. But if a caliphate was established, a real one, and not one a fake one set up by some Iraqi Ba'athists, along with their friend, who's the Syrian Ba'athists, then it would be, things would be a little different. And of course, as I've always said, we should be steadfast in pursuing this goal, but we should pursue it, obviously, not using violence, because history has always shown. Well, history has always shown that those who are patient and are obviously stick to doing what's right and not to transgressing or doing violence always achieve their goals sooner or later. But that's not the reason. The real reason is because this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to do, and it's prohibited for us to use violence. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala prohibited this, so we must implement the Prophet's example to achieve this. You know, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam never used violence to get the state of Medina. He didn't do an uprising or insurgency or even a violent revolution to get the first Islamic state in Medina. He actually did it by persuasion. And that's how we should do it in the Muslim world. We should do it by persuasion. So that's about my point to that. Anyone has any other points, criticisms? Oh, sister over there.
Do you think an Islamic caliphate is realistic? Do you think
okay, so this is also a good argument. Is the idea of Islamic caliphate is it feasible? Well, firstly, if all our ancestors from 1,200 years came today, they would be absolutely aghast. There is no caliphate now, because for most of 1,000—that's a long time, by the way. For 1,300 years, there was one. Muslims, even under the Mongols, there was a few blips for one or two years, and then they re-established it after the fall of Baghdad. But there was always a caliph, and always a caliphate. So they'd be absolutely aghast. But here's the thing. Not Muslim countries aren't occupied by foreign soldiers anymore. They're occupied by soldiers who come from our own people. They obey their commanders, and their commanders obviously come from our own people. Everyone in the Muslim countries, for the most part, are Muslim in majority Muslim countries, or most people in majority Muslim countries are Muslim. Now, the only reason they live in the way they live is because they think that's acceptable to live that way, and that they don't know anything better. Really, the only barrier between us and establishing a Islamic government is literally just changing people's minds. It's as simple as that. So if anyone here right now believes that Islamic caliphate is something that should be worked for, and you would work for it with all halal means possible, peaceful means of course, if you believe that, then how is it so difficult for you to get someone else to believe the same? And if you go to your countries and just get people there to believe exactly the same you do, if you get them to believe the same way you do, then of course it would be inevitable. Some would say that the change that's happening since the 1980s is due to an Islamic, a gradual Islamic resurgence and revival happening in the Muslim world. Even in secular Turkey, like it was Kemalist secular Turkey, Turks, many majority of Turks, or arguably a significant majority of Turks, are now nostalgic for the days of the Ottoman Caliphate. They talk about it with such longing, yeah, such awe, and they talk about Islam, and you would never imagine this 20 years ago in Turkey. You would never think of this. It's a concerning thing to the foreign powers, but these are changes are happening. So, for example, obviously Iran was under a secular government. Arguably, you could say it still is, but the interesting thing is that the sentiment for Islam might not know exactly what it looks like, but there was a sentiment for Islam. Likewise, in Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood obviously won the elections, there was a sentiment for Islam. In fact, if you did elections, usually Islamic groups always win. The problem is that because we've been so long without Islamic government and we don't even know what it looks like or how to operate it or the details, that they don't know what to even do. And the second point is that the army remains secular and probably wouldn't allow that anyway. I mean, we know what happened to Mohamed al-Morsi. He wasn't really in control, and everyone knows he wasn't in control of Egypt. So, but look at that. There was a movement towards that sentiment, a growing sentiment. If you know what, I looked at these pictures in Afghanistan 30 years ago, right? These pictures of Afghanistan 30 years ago, and there were women wearing kind of not mini skirts, but kind of really high up skirts and open blouses, and I was thinking, well, what? That doesn't look like what I'm seeing now. I'm not saying that Afghanistan now, in materially or in all aspects, is an improvement back then since then. But all I'm saying is that shows there is some kind of sentiment. I mean, Afghanistan's been under war for 30 years, so it's not going to be the most technologically advanced country in the Middle East. And if some people think, oh, but, Muslims, when have we actually achieved anything, even in the modern day, Muslims who desire Islam, what kind of technological advancement or economic advancement can we ever achieve? Well, here's the interesting thing, is the most advanced countries in the Middle East are the ones who have the most Islamic sentiment. Give you an example. Again, I don't agree with the Iranian government. I certainly don't agree what they're doing in Syria to our brothers and sisters there. However, they are one of only 10 countries in the world that has a completely independent space program, which means they make their satellites, they make the rocket that takes the satellite up, and they have a spaceport, and it's all self-contained. They don't need to ship it to NASA or to Russia to get it launched from Kazakhstan for them on their behalf. They can do it themselves, and they've done it. And only 10 countries in the entire planet have a fully contained space program, as in independent, they can launch their own satellites. That's amazing. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. I disagree with the Iranian government, and I strongly criticize what they're doing in Syria, strongly, but at least that shows what the power of Islamic sentiment and forward thinking can do. Likewise, obviously, Turkey is most economically, it became much more economically abundant and successful, obviously, during the AKP party's tenor. And they've noticed that Muslims who, well, Western politicians and others have said that many Islamists seem to come from university-educated backgrounds, are successful business entrepreneurs and engineers and so on and so forth. Well, if that's what Islamism does, then surely it exposes the lie that Islamism is retrograde, backward, or medieval. If the most developed countries in the world, the most developed countries in the Middle East, are actually ones with more Islamic leaning. Contrast this to Mubarak, Egypt, Mubarak's time when he was ruling Egypt. Egypt wanted to create a first satellite, right, to get it built somewhere else, and then get it shot up into space somewhere else because they couldn't make it themselves. And America came in and stopped them because Israel complained, it was worried it would send a spy satellite up that would be able to look at Israel, and so they didn't like that. So they basically, that stopped Egypt's space program, and Egypt complied. That's what secular governments are doing in the Middle East, complying to the demands of foreigners. At least governments that have more Islamic sentiment at least are a bit more independent. Brady, I don't agree, don't say to me, oh, Abdullah, which government is Islamic? I'd probably say none, but I'm just showing you, here's what the power of just Islamic sentiment, increasing Islamic sentiment can achieve. So imagine what can be achieved with a fully independent Islamic caliphate, elected caliph, which we have precedent for from the time of the Khalifa Rashida, elected caliph, accountable under law, transparent government, and plurality, Christians, Jews, atheists, others can live, like in the past, about Abu Hanifa was debating against who? Atheists in Islamic Baghdad, right? So they weren't killed or massacred or whatever. So why can't we do this again? In fact, it was probably more enlightened. The Muslim was more enlightened back then than it is, well, certainly than it is now. So why can't we recreate it? And you can't recreate by just looking at old history books and go, oh, so great, oh, Rumi and all these, and using the English terms, Avicenna, so Ibn Rushd, right? No, it's great, yeah, that's great history, right? History book aside, now what we can do now and what we're going to do tomorrow? We don't ask ourselves these questions. We should. And the moment you get Muslims to ask the same questions that you're thinking right now is the moment that we can actually change our situation. Any other final points?
Right now in America, in Afghanistan, there's a few US soldiers.
Yeah.
And now that Trump has been elected, he wants to get their soldiers out there. What do you think of that? How would Afghanistan improve in the future? How would it control the extremism and stuff like that?
How would Afghanistan control extremism? That's a very big subject.
What statement to make, of course, but...
Well, all I'll say is, look, I'm not going to really answer this here because that's a different discussion. All I'll say is we should stop using the word extremism. What meaning does it have? People said, oh, but extremism means ghulu in Arabic. It just means ghulu, right? Oh, you know, the Khawarij, they were ghulat. It's like, well, you know what? And the argument is that extremism isn't because of foreign policy. Islam has always had extremism. That's the argument. This is the argument they say. Islam has always had extremist element to it, and they bring up the Khawarij to show this. Well, guess what? The Khawarij were transgressors, right? They were zalimin. They were fasqin, but they weren't ghulat. Why do I say that? Well, ghulu in Islam means that it's something that you do. If you do a little bit of it, it's good. If you do too much of it, it goes outside the limits. The Khawarij were not... Khawarij didn't commit ghulu because that would mean that, oh, they killed too many innocent people. If they only killed a few innocent people, then that's... No, it's bad enough to kill one innocent person, right? It's not. They did too much of it. Good to know my directions. So the Khawarij were, as Imam Ali said, they were transgressors. That's what the name for them is. They transgressed the laws of God. There is no word for extremism in Islamic texts and literature. Yeah, of course you have Tatarruf and in modern standard Arabic, which we've kind of borrowed from the West, the meaning of it. Back in the old days, it would never mean extremism. We never had this understanding of extremism. But now we borrowed the concept, the idea, and now we use it in our discourse. How do we get rid of extremism? Well, how do you get rid of unicorns? You know, what does that mean? It doesn't mean. It's just an abstract concept in our heads. How do you get rid of terrorism? Now we're talking. Now I understand what that means. How do we get rid of killing or theft or corruption? These are things that we can understand. But extremism is a nebulous concept. And if you buy into that word, using that word, then you are already kind of fallen foul of their particular agenda to make us look at Islam in terms of scales of extreme and not extreme. There is no scales of extreme or not extreme in Islam. There's only you transgress or you do too much of a good thing and it goes beyond the limits of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ghulu. But not, there is no such thing as, oh, it's one extreme, not extreme. That doesn't exist in, and ghulu is translated as excess. It's better to translate as excess. So we see the Prophet Muhammad was with his companion. The companion said, during the Hajj, you know, we have to stone a pillar. And one Sahaba was thinking, you know, should he get like a big boulders or big rocks to stone this pillar as part of the ritual, the Hajj ritual? And the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ obviously told him that just get rocks the size of date stones or what have you. Don't go to ghulu in religion. Don't go to excess. Because yeah, you have to do the ritual, but don't do it with such a, don't add stuff to it that you kind of make it a burden for yourself or you make it more troublesome than it is. Don't go to excess in that matter. Right, so that's where ghulu comes from. But extremism doesn't exist as a concept in Islam. Transgression and dhulam, so fisk and dhulam, this does exist in Islam. Breaking the limits of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that exists. We can understand that, but not extremism. Is that the cue to shut me up? One final point from the audience, or if any of you do have any content, can anyone else disagree with me at some point? Just say, look, I disagree with this, or make a contention, any contention of any kind, of anything I've said, or just challenge anything you think I haven't provided evidence for. What, you all agree with me? That's no fun. We should have had a debate here today. All right. Well, what I'll say is that JazakAllah here for listening, and inshallah, a lot of this stuff I've discussed, I'll put up the evidences for on my site at some point in the next couple of weeks, inshallah, so you can check the references for yourself. I suggest you do, and please go and check for yourself everything I've said. And as to the topic today's question, is counter-terrorism policies encouraging or creating Islamophobia? I'm not going to answer it, but I think you have all the evidence for yourself to answer that question for yourself. Not all counter-terrorism policies, but are there any aspects of it which you think have gone beyond the limits of what counterterrorism should be? And is that creating Islamophobia? I'll leave it to you to decide. Thanks for listening.